Right, I think we're on, ladies and gentlemen. We have stiff competition, as you will see from somewhat depleted numbers. But all these people are jolly good. I've read their scary books. I'm very squeamish, so I'm a strange choice as moderator of this panel. But I sort of opted for it because I thought I should stop being so mimsy about violence and torture and all sorts of nasty things. So I had to read a few bits of all these books with my eyes shut. They're responsible for them. They're going to introduce themselves, because what I really want them to tell you is what drove them to write scary stuff and what they did that makes them uniquely makes qualified to write scary stuff. And we'll start with Matt.
I'm not that scary. I'm wearing a pink shirt, so that's a reality check. I actually have a background in the police force and also private security, and also for past 25 years of my life I've been training in and teaching martial arts and around combat. Because of that background, that actually influences my writing. I wanted to write stories that I like to read, and I like fast-moving action thrillers. So it's not a case of a whodunit. It's a this has happened, and this is the consequence of that violence, and what the actual spillout is from there. The idea behind my writing is that I like to write in cinematic flashes, so it's all based on the actual action and the dynamics of that action that I try to put down in my writing. Because I have been engaged in numerous nasty situations dealing with nasty people, feel that I can actually put that into my writing. I know what the fear factor is like. I know what it feels like to be hit, and even just the fear of the expectation of the crime. That's what I like to try and put across in my writing. So
right, thank you. We'll follow that one,
Zoe. I feel like I've just been handed the wheel of the Exxon Valdez. my name's Zoe Sharp. I write a series about a character. She's come out of the British Army and is now working as a bodyguard. And really, I wanted to explore what happens to ex-military characters. Women are still very much not quite looked down upon in the British forces, but they are certainly not regarded as in any way equal to the men. And I wondered what would happen if you took a character who would have been equal to the men, given the chance, but they don't want her to succeed, so she ends up getting punted out of her career in the army, and she's then at a loss to fit into civilian society. As people who've been through that kind of training often are, they don't quite fit in, and a lot of them go into private security work, as you've said, or they go into close protection work. So I took Charlie into being a bodyguard, and that's a very useful outlet for her abilities and her sort of psychological makeup, really, because female characters who have the ability to kill in fiction are so often portrayed as either cold-blooded assassins, or they're complete psychos.
Yeah,
I wanted
you to talk a bit about yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, I am neither a cold-blooded assassin nor a psycho. Basically, I started writing crime fiction after receiving death threat letters in the course of my work as a photojournalist.
Very good. Eve?
I have no background in what my character does at all, unless you count having five children in sort of 8 years as brutal. The reason I got into writing this particular character, Paul Tallis, who I'll just fill in, is ex-army, ex-firearms officer, and that's really key, because I got interested after the Stockwell shooting, and I was thinking, what must it be like to be one of those firearms officers that has killed this guy? And because of that, I managed to chat up somebody who was a firearms officer, and I went to the headquarters where they train, and spent about 4 hours on the 21st of December 2005, when everybody was still talking about Stockwell, doing a simulated training exercise, and that really got me going, and hence Paul Tallis was probably born on the 21st of December 2005.
Adrian.
I'm Adrian Maxson. I also do not have a background which bears any resemblance to the kind of books that I write. I used to be a martial arts instructor for several years, but I'm quite house-trained, and I don't use very much of it in my books, but it does give me a hint of the things that can go on. I used to actually write romantic fiction for women's magazines, so it's actually quite a jump, I suppose, that I've made to write this kind of thing. Ruth worried me when she was giving her quick brief on these books being fairly gruesome. I don't think my books are that gruesome, but maybe we'll get to that later. But I wanted to... I chose a female lead, which is fairly unusual for a male writer, I suppose, but I balanced it with a male who comes into the sort of special forces category in that he's an ex-Royal Military policeman, purely because I wanted the detection skills, the weapons knowledge. But my lead character is an investigative reporter, and I use her because she's downright bloody nosy, and it allows me to get into sort of stories where the two of them can actually get on with solving it.
The after, I mean, you're doing the now, not what happens to somebody after they've been...
It's usually the consequence. The violence, I just wanted to stress it in my books, it's a kind of metaphor for the need for someone to stand up for the rights of themselves and for others around them. It's not just, you know, we were kind of flipping about the gruesome aspects. It's more about the skills that the chap possesses. The character in my book's an ex-counterterrorism agent who's now retired, who's now using his skills as a bit of an urban vigilante. But it's to stand up for people who are, you know, suffering violence from others. And he feels he's in a position to help others who aren't able to help themselves. So his violence is like a metaphor for putting wrongs to right, if that makes sense. Sorry.
That's a question, actually, I'd like to put to the panel. That we have two competing attitudes to violence now. I mean, we're absolutely anti it, and that unfortunate policeman in Stockwell, I mean, he was... really hounded whoever actually fired the shot. At the same time, we're life on Mars, all this sort of stuff, we're longing for vigilantes, but we're making it impossible for them to operate.
That's right.
So what is, this is a hidden aspect of us, really. What do we want? Do we want vigilantes? Do we want more health and safety?
No.
I do realise that we should have done a risk assessment before climbing onto this platform up here. Health and safety is just getting, you know, ridiculous. You're not allowed to climb a stepladder to change a light bulb in a library now if you're a librarian, apparently, without a risk assessment and training.
So is this fuelling our desire to have more novels about vigilantes?
It's a safety net, isn't it? It's the less we are allowed to do in reality, the more we want this escapist fiction. And also, how often, you know, if you get burgled, if you have anything stolen, the most likely result is that they're not going to catch the person who did it. If they do, they're going to get a caution or community service. You're not going to get your stuff back. So we want that kind of closure that fiction gives us, and we want to be able to sit there and go, yes, you know, the little man got his revenge, which sadly does not happen very often in real life.
Do you think that's what it's about,
Eve? I was just thinking about this. I had a conversation with a farms officer who was very indignant about police officers being given tasers, and tasers are stun guns, basically, and they're very painful, and they do incapacitate you. And he was... very indignant about it because he didn't think that it was their role to have these things. It's our job to do that sort of thing. So I think that's quite interesting because he's basically saying they shouldn't be allowed to do this, we should be the only people who are allowed to do this. So there's a kind of rivalry going on about who's in charge, I suppose, and who metes out the, not the punishment, but who takes charge of a situation. You're talking about... sorry, I've lost my thread.
Vigilantes,
yes. So I suppose I've gone slightly off track because I'm talking about within the police force, what they think should be done and what shouldn't. I mean, the police are very, very anti people taking the law into their own hands.
Yeah.
But actually having conversations with people, they do understand sometimes why people do that, because the law is a bit of an ass sometimes.
Do you talk to police?
The only policeman I've spoken to was fairly recently. Frank Palmer, who's the ex-military policeman, uses an ASP, which is a telescopic baton. And I'd got no clue how these things worked. And I thought, well, you know, for reality, I'd better check. And so I went to the police station and said, could I speak to a policeman about the equipment that they use? Because mine aren't police procedural, so I don't have a great deal of police etiquette and procedure in them, so I tend not to worry about the detail too much. But I wanted Riley, who's the reporter, to actually use this ASP if she had to. And I thought, well, is there a different one for women police officers? In some forces, apparently, there is. But this chap came out, and he looked like RoboCop. Now, I hadn't actually stood next to a policeman for a long time. Well, I never stood next to a policeman.
Except when you're helping them with their inquiries.
That's right, yes. And this chap came out, and he was covered in stuff that looked as though it had been Velcroed on. And I said, I need to know how you use the telescopic baton. He said, oh, you mean this? And he sort of flicked it out. And that really answered my question. So that was the only time, I have to say, I said, can I have a go with it? He said, yeah, sure, hold it. And I said, well, he said, just flick it. So I went, boom, and it came out. And I thought, I felt so empowered, I wanted to hit something. It was great. And but that's the only time I've ever spoken to a policeman. I've spoken to the MOD police because that was an entirely separate issue. I just wanted to know about training issues. But no, I haven't spoken to policemen about forensics or rather scenes of crime because I tend not to get involved in that either.
So would you know a lot nowadays about police competition, intra-police competition?
As
in jealousy, that tasers are being handed out to any.
Yes, definitely.
Do you get what I'm saying about that?
Yes,
that
I do. There's a feeling even within the police force, the firearms teams think they should only be armed with tasers because they're the only ones with the training to use them and the responsibility to use them, really. They're afraid that I wasn't a firearms officer. They think that setting me loose with a taser, I'm going to be going around zapping everybody just to see, you know, what the effects are. But I actually agree with them that the police officer on the street shouldn't have them.
No. And also, just to cut across, specials who are armed with CS gas.
Yeah.
I've talked to them and they say, yeah, it's great. We get in there, we just go tss, like that.
Yeah.
And you think, this is CS gas, it's awful stuff.
There is
an interesting little point that you have to bear in mind when you're carrying this type of equipment, which is if you squirt somebody with CS gas, the propellant in it is flammable. And therefore, if you taser them afterwards, they have a tendency to ignite. Which is a little bit of a drawback. And also the armed police in Cumbria, I spent some time going out on the road with the armed police in Cumbria, and initially the tasers were kept in the lockbox in the vehicle with the firearms. And then somebody realised that actually keeping an electromagnetic discharge weapon in a box with ammunition was maybe not such a good idea. And then now they carry them, but they're only allowed to actually deploy them when they're given the same authorisation as when they're allowed to use firearms.
I've got this image of policemen with the spray in one hand, the taser in the other, braising a steak.
Going make my day, yes.
Just a point on the ASP that was raised earlier on. The only time I ever used my ASP was to open it to, you know, rattle about in something horrible that I didn't want to touch with my hands. You know, that's generally the reality of what you use your ASP
for.
It's
then folding it up again afterwards. That's the thing. But the noise of those is specially designed when they come out and the telescopic segments lock into place. It was designed to sound like a pump-action shotgun racking, because that noise instantly kind of, you know, is supposed to yes. Or escalate it. Enough about your private life, Ed.
Yes, somebody did say that this would probably consist of Zoe telling us 30 ways of killing people.
Only 30? How long have we got?
Do you enjoy inventing ways of killing people? Not Zoe.
I haven't invented ways. I think my characters tend not to kill. I mean, they don't carry firearms because it's all in the UK. And I try and sort of retain some sort of verisimilitude, but they're not policemen, they're not soldiers, they don't carry firearms. But I did have a case where Riley wanted to shoot somebody, and she'd actually managed to take the gun off this sort of would-be gangster. And I thought, do I want my female character to actually kill somebody? And I decided, no, I don't, because what else follows on from there? You know, what else did you do? Blow up the Houses of Parliament? Well, that might be a good idea. But they tend not to go around killing people, except in the last one, Frank Palmer actually does kill somebody. And that was purely because the guy had murdered his former girlfriend. And I couldn't actually see any other way, because he was a Russian criminal, he wasn't going to get charged, he wasn't going to be brought to justice. And that was the only time I've ever used martial arts in the book. And I did consult with a friend just to make sure. And he killed him with a martial arts move. It seemed to me, that's disposed of him, you know, it's justice.
You don't worry too much about this, do you, Matt, of killing people?
No, because my books, there's a certain fantasy aspect to the books in that it's a bit like the, the blockbuster movie where people are killed as a course of the action. I chose to set my books in America because, like Adrian just pointed out, you wouldn't get away with it in the UK. You know, I've said this a few times, if there's a car chase from, you know, Carlisle where I live, you've hit Preston in an hour and a half, you know, and it's unrealistic. To have, you know, like a serial killer travelling the length of the country, which happens in my book, killing different people along the way, they'd probably be caught within a couple of days in this country, whereas the scope and the magnitude of the United States allowed me that kind of, you know, free will, really, to just allow bigger action scenes to happen. So, you know, I think people have that tendency to allow, you know, a little bit of leeway, open the mind to the scenes, and the culmination of the scene does often end in death. You know, it's guns, it's knives, it's hand-to-hand combat.
Yeah. Yes, I think you two are really at the opposite ends of the spectrum, in that you're worrying about the effect of doing a violent act on the person who commits the violent act.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And that's what drives your...
Yeah. And I mean, there's a redemptive element in The Last Exile, because it's the consequences of actually shooting somebody, and in the split second before you shoot them, under orders... you sense that actually they're innocent, and that horrible feeling of looking into somebody's eyes and thinking, I've been ordered to take this person out, they're supposed to be a suicide bomber, but I don't think they are, and then having to do it, and then finding out they were actually innocent, and the whole, how that impacts on somebody. And that's a theme throughout the entire book, and of course there's a redemptive element, so towards the end he gets to sort of redeem himself. But that was very powerful for me as a theme for the book. So it's more about, it's not the killing, it's about what it does to your main character, and also how it sort of runs throughout the entire novel.
Yes, there's it's competition, really, I shouldn't say it, but there's a first novel coming out very shortly by a guy called Stuart Neville called The Twelve, which has got astonishing reviews ahead of time, and it is a brilliant, absolutely brilliant book, which is about an IRA killer who is haunted by the ghosts of his victims and goes out to avenge the people he killed. It's an astonishing look at this, because it really hasn't been done a lot, trying to understand what the violence does. Would the police worry about that? Your police mates, do they talk a lot about Stockwell, or were they more annoyed with the media response?
A bit of both, to be honest, because obviously you see what the media wants you to see, and obviously they can spin a story, you know, to suit. It was a terrible thing. It was a terrible thing. I don't want to kind of make a political statement on it. It did affect people, on predominantly the firearms teams, because obviously it put the same emphasis on them. I mean, I've never held a gun, fired a gun, shot a person in my life or anything like that, but even I was getting comments on the street, you know, from people in the street, as if I was going to shoot someone, you know. So it had that knock-on effect in my experience. So that was the main thing, the backlash from the public.
And the very same people who go home and watch Life on Mars and wish the police...
And wish the police were like that, at the same time, Strange.
No, I was just saying, it seems to me that there are two kinds of book. One is the one like Eve's that explores the consequences of violence, and as you said, it becomes a redemptive kind of book. Or there are the others which tend to use violence either, like, as Matt says, a sort of cartoonish representation, or those that are probably, there's a lower death count, but maybe it uses it in another way. And certainly, like you mentioned, the Life from Mars, you know, you can picture everybody sitting in there chairs and going, yeah, go on, Gene, because you want him to do the things that they can't do. But it's cartoonish, but fairly serious at the same time.
The other thing about violence is, if you have
your character actually watching something take place, and they cannot do anything about it, because if they do so, they will break their own cover. Because there's a bit with Talis where he basically gets seconded to work for the Home Office, which is MI5, and he has to go undercover, and he has to be like these other people, these drug lords. And there's a scene where a woman is being tortured, and it's a really nasty scene in the book. And I did get criticised by a couple of people saying, "We didn't know you had that in your head. How could you do this?" But the reason for it was that Talis has to watch it and do nothing at all about it, because it's about the bigger story. It's about having to pull off his cover, because he couldn't have saved her anyway. It's having to watch it. So that's using violence to say something about your character, whether you think that's good or bad, you know, whether you think he should have gone in and stopped it, or that's a different thing. But it does show you something about a character. So you can use violence in that way.
Yes, I wanted to talk about torture, because that's one of the bits where I shut my eyes. The use of torture in books, because they were saying earlier in the green room that one of you was asked to tone it down and the other one was asked to ramp it up.
Mm.
So could you just tell us about you and torture? How much do you enjoy writing it? Do you need it? Do you want to do more? Do you want to do less? Do your editors want you to do more or less? What does the public want?
With the torture scene in my book, it has to be taken in context. And again, mm-hmm. I just want to point out, interesting before we're talking about redemption and the effects violence has on you, that also plays a big part in my writing, and it's why my character is the way he is, and he wants to defend people from being tortured and being, you know, people being violent to them. And the scene is his brother being tortured by a killer, which actually drives him then to the actions that he takes to, you know, make the killer pay for his crime, basically. But I wanted also an image that goes back to the Norwegian blood eagle. You know, you're possibly aware of it, where the skin was cut down the back and then opened up so it looked like wings.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds horrible and gory, and you know, but that image was important to the plot. But you know, for the American version, it's my American editor who asked for that to be toned down because of the sensibilities of the readers. However, for the British market, it seems to be fine. You know, so
yes.
Maybe we're a little bit more acclimatised to reading them things. It sounds gorier in the telling than what it actually is in the book. And was,
should have taken that by hearing aid.
Yeah.
Torture, yes, does it work?
If it's in context. It's like any form of violence. There is a big difference between graphic and gratuitous. And I think you can get away with graphic violence in a novel if it isn't gratuitous to the plot. But at very minor levels of violence, if they are completely irrelevant to the plot and just put in there because your editor said you need to have some more violence, and they feel wrong, don't they? If you're trying to introduce them artificially, they need to grow out of the story. It has to be right for that character at that moment, in that point in the plot, that this needs to happen. And the torture scene, yes, I was the one whose American editor got squeamish and asked me to tone it down. But actually, there was very little graphic violence on the page. It's like the shower scene in Psycho. You all think you see the woman being stabbed. You never actually see the knife going in, but your brain fills in all the blanks between those little scenes. But they never actually showed the knife penetrating. So you fill in all those bits and you think you've seen the most horrific stabbing, but you haven't. And I tried to do that with this scene. It's an unpleasant scene, as it's supposed to be, and it makes a point at the time of a man who is a very high-principled, decent man, who is driven to that extreme of behaviour in order to, you know, to rescue someone who is very important to him. And he's a surgeon by trade, so that is, you know, the human body holds no secrets for him. He's a highly paid mechanic, and it's a machine that he deals with on a daily basis. So therefore, his attitude to how he approaches that is very different from the sort of very brutal aspect. He's a very clinical guy when it comes to that kind of torture. So,
right. Well, I ask question now from another angle: does torture actually work? Because this is
in
a
context.
Great debate now in America. No, I don't mean.
Oh, sorry.
Does it
in reality,
no, I don't think so. I'd tell anybody anything if I was being tortured. So no, I don't think it does work. And also, I think if you're saying that this is wrong, which presumably governments say this is wrong, then how can you mete out those kind of punishments on people? I don't think it works. I don't think it works.
Do you have a view on this, Adrian?
I don't know about in real life. I'd like to think that it doesn't, but purely for some ends, in real life, it probably does. It gets information. It shouldn't be used. But in terms of what we're talking about in books, it can form part of the plot because there's tension, there's fear, there's pain. But there's also implied torture, so you don't actually have to go through it. And I had a torture scene in my last book where Riley Gavin, the young journalist, she'd been kidnapped by Russian mafia and had her face held over a basin of boiling water into which they poured bleach. And I was trying to think, well, I clearly don't want my main character having her face burnt off. You know, that really wouldn't work very well. But the fear, I would imagine, for most women, let alone men, but certainly for women, of having bleach anywhere near their face is bad enough. Boiling water with it. And the implication was that the guy had his hand on the back of her neck and was going to push her face in if she didn't do what she was told. And my editor came back and said, could you ramp it up a bit? And I thought, what do I introduce? You know, acid? So I kept it as it was because I felt that that was threat enough. And it worked for that particular scene. So I don't think you really need to go into all of the detail, but I have read plenty of books where torture is very much slice and dice, and you know, it works for the writer that's writing those particular books. It doesn't always work for the readers, I guess. I have to say, I don't always like reading about detailed torture. It kind of repels me a bit.
You're allowed to say that.
Am I?
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes, you're allowed to say that. Matt might approve.
No, I totally agree. In my book, the torturer is the bad man, not the good man, you know, so I want to stress that as well. You know, it's not the hero that's torturing people, it's the serial killer, you know, so, and again, it's just to actually ramp him up as this bad man, you know, to make people root for the actions, because, you know, let's face it, I was a police officer, I can't advocate vigilantism. But under those extreme circumstances, I think anybody would understand. He's done that to my brother. I want payback. You know, and that's the angle that I was coming back for that scene. So, but I totally agree with what Eric just said. You know, if it's over gory or it's gratuitous, no, I don't think there's any place for it.
Let's talk about evil. Does it exist?
Oh, no. I was looking over that away, thinking, oh, you always ask me the big questions. It doesn't exist as a creature. I think evil exists in all of us. I'm sure I could be evil. Given the right pressure points, if somebody did something to one of my children, I'd want to kill them, yeah. But is that evil? Isn't that...
I think that's rather different from somebody who goes around just killing children for the hell of it.
Oh gosh, yes. Yes, but I believe that people who meet out evil have often had evil done to them. It's no, people don't just wake up and decide they're going to kill children one day. They get to that point, and it's the shaping and all those bits and pieces in between. I mean, most of us have come from sort of, I presume, reasonably normal, whatever counts for normal these days, families. But if you come from a very dysfunctional background and there's no decent teacher to act a parental role, or there's no stopgaps in between, yes, I think that's how people can become distorted. Or if you've grown up in a war zone and you've seen the most appalling things and your family have been annihilated, yes, that. But I don't think evil exists as an entity in its own.
But you can become evil.
I mean, there is an argument where people say that, you know, psychopaths are born. You know, there's a genetic sort of problem. But I'm much more of the view that it's about choices in life, and some people have more limited choices, and therefore they go down a wrong path.
There is a certain amount of nature, I think, involved, but an awful lot of nurture involved in that one.
Totally agree.
Would you have a?
I was just thinking the exact same thing. What you'll find is I came from a rough housing estate in Carlisle, but there was good people, there was bad people, and I think it was moral choices sometimes that led people down to the route where they were, you know, turning to burgling or turning to, you know, stealing or whatever to give themselves a better life. They never ever achieved anything because they were still miserable people at the end of the day. But then there was others who, you know, if they had a strong, stable family life where they had the right lessons, they, you know, they tended to turn out well. I think what you asked originally about evil, if we get away from the religious context, I think it's a matter of choices over time that builds a person from, you know, they get the seed and it then leads them on. And if they don't have the restraint or the, you know, the self-discipline to allow that to fester, then yeah, you can go and do terrible deeds. Yeah.
Adrian?
My personal opinion, I think I don't use the word or think of the word evil very much because I tend to think of degrees of badness. Most of the villains in my books are gangsters of one sort or another. So the evil question tends not to arise. And I do think there are varying degrees of badness in what people do to each other. I've read serial killer books, and yes, certainly people there are portrayed as out and out evil. But I'm not sure the word really has any sort of validity at the moment. I do think it's been overused to a degree that it's now assigned to all sorts of things which aren't necessarily evil. It could be because of nurture or nature. Somebody's done an awful thing, but they may have done it for all sorts of reasons that never seem to be really gone into. So I think evil's like this. It's not a creature, I agree with Eve. It seems to be this sort of vague thing out there that people want to fasten onto. And it's not. It's not a concept. It's people.
Don't you think it makes us feel? Obviously, it makes some people feel safer. If it's evil, it's something that just happened.
It's a label.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
That.
It's easy to
so
put
it's
a label
it's
on
easier
something.
To
yeah.
I prefer a certain amount of ambiguity, I think, in my books. What you would think of as the villains often behave in ways that are more honourable than people who are supposed to be the good guys. Because even in certainly in fiction, even the villains are the hero of their own story to themselves. You know, they see what they're doing as the right thing or the thing that they want to do. So they don't see themselves as rushing around in a big black cape, you know, cackling, because because they are the personification of evil. You know, that's I try and stick a little bit more to reality.
Can you explain to me why people keep calling killers cowardly? I mean, take the shooting of those two unfortunate soldiers in Northern Ireland recently. Just Pat, Secretary of State, comes out and says, cowardly murder. Gordon Brown says cowardly. It's not actually cowardly, but it's become a word that has to be used because it's thought to talk down the crime or something. Do you understand that?
Well,
it's an attempt to belittle the killers, isn't it? Because it's a very sensitive issue, and I was in Northern Ireland a few weeks ago, and in fact trying to do photo shoots at night when you've got flash guns going off soon arouses the interest of the armed police, I can tell you that. But it's a very difficult situation, and these people are not seen as straightforward murderers. You know, to certain sections they are heroes, they are martyrs. This is not a straightforward crime. From that point of view, it's a lot more politically motivated. And I'm going to now instantly shut up because I can hear myself going, politics, no.
Matt, use the word cowardly.
So, well, cowardly, it's probably... It's like you said, it's to breed a contempt of the actions and against a political statement. I think the term cowardly, it's because nobody likes cowards. They didn't stand up, you know, put up your dukes. It wasn't that kind of thing. So, you know, that was the honourable way to sort your differences at one time. And if you were a coward, you were loathed. And I think it's that political aspect, really. That's why that term's used these days, I think.
Right. Not accurate. You have any thoughts on that, Eve?
I think it says more about the person who's using the phrase cowardly, actually, than it does about... It's to play it down. It's, you know... Actually, because it's political, that's exactly why they use that phrase.
Like in good faith.
Yes. Yeah.
Let's have a couple of questions. And there is a prize, as you probably know from other panels, a prize for the question we like most, which I gather means the question I like most, because I'm impossible. Yes.
If you're... Did you point to me?
Sorry. Yes.
Are you all happy to kill
the nature of my books, it has to kind of have a resolution. So although me as an individual, I believe in the processes of you know, natural process and using the law and everything, the character in the book thought, no, he wants you know, to finalise things, make a statement really. And I think that's by the nature of his mentality, he'll do that. Doesn't necessarily mean I would do that though, you know, just the character himself would do that. That's how he'd actually want finality to the situation.
Sorry, what was the question?
The question was, do you tend to deal with the bad people by killing them or by due process?
Oh yeah, I'd always like to say kill the bastards and that's done with, but occasionally I allow them to die because they're not police procedurals. They tend not to get to the court situation. But I had one book where, well, this latest book, somebody was killed and they were a baddie, but others were arrested, and one was disposed of by a security organisation because it seemed to be the best thing to do. But in one book, I had a thoroughly out-and-out baddie who had been the cause of death of several runaway teenagers in London. And he was just a nasty individual, and I wasn't really sure whether having two semi-professional sleuths, an investigative reporter and an ex-military policeman, hand over this character to the police, because, you know, what would happen? He was a foreign national anyway, so I thought, well, yeah, you might get away with it. So I actually had Frank Palmer allow him to burn to death in a van at the end of the book. And, in fact, he was trapped in this van. There was no way that he was going to come out. And I thought, yep, that's the best way to deal with him, because it's going to get him out of the book. He's got his comeuppances, and it seemed to suit the whole sort of plot. So, yeah, he burned.
I think as long as you have a sense of closure, you don't necessarily need... It's one of those sort of movie clichés, isn't it, that the chief bad guy, when he's been disarmed, will always reach for a second hidden gun, thus ensuring he gets himself shot rather than, you know, being handed over. And that's one of those clichés that always pops up. So I don't necessarily see that you have to kill the bad guy in the final frame. Oh, Matt!
Hello, dear. I'm on a panel.
I can't talk now. I'm in an art gallery, yes. So, it's a sense of closure. And because we've been talking about the effect, the consequences, the main character I have, she recognises her own ability to kill, and she's not necessarily happy with that ability, but she recognises it's there, and therefore having her killing off the bad guys left, right and centre, she'd be even more of a wreck possibly than she is a lot of the time because of the consequences of those actions. So,
just before I ask Eve to comment on that, I liked the fact that you said it sounded like the music, the incidental music to a television series.
That's my theme tune when I walk in a room. It's pure chance actually.
Yes, I used to have a theme tune which was "What Shall We Do with the Drunken Sailor?" Only it went off, and I am not exaggerating. It went off as my aunt's coffin slid into the fire.
Oh, wow.
That was embarrassing. Not easily embarrassed, but I was embarrassed. The bottom of my handbag too. Yes, sorry, Eve.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to give the plot away, but Paul Tallis ends up not killing, but shooting to disable. And there's a very good reason for that, because the character actually appears in the Mephisto threat that comes out in July. But he disables him enough, and the police are out. So he's taken off the scene, and in fact, he ends up in prison. So he's put away, but he's not actually shot dead.
But your intonation would be due process. You're a good liberal, I can tell.
Oh dear, I don't know if that's, yes. Yes, so, but having said that, because you're talking about morality here, because you talked in terms of the books being sort of moral tales, am I right? Yes, there is a lot of morality actually in the novel, because Tallis is charged with picking up illegal immigrants who should have been deported after they've been released from prison, and basically they wind up dead, and he realises then that he's caught in something that he shouldn't be. And he's very moralistic at the end, because he actually realises he's been involved in a sort of sting operation, And these people were used as bait, and which says something about today, I think, and how we view illegals. So there's a very strong moral thing. So I didn't really need to shoot dead the bad guy at the end, because you have this other, you have this closure in that sense at the end of the book. Yes.
Over the last sort of couple of years, along with an increase in sort of, you know, massive health and safety paranoia, there's also been a huge sort of drive towards investigating the investigators, both the police and the military. And what sort of impact has that had in terms of your characters, or maybe even your readership, in terms of, you know, have you got more, have you got fewer, do you think you need to bring those issues much more to the fore? I mean, clearly your book obviously focuses quite heavily on that, but what are the...
Well, I back the system, because basically Talis is an off-the-book spook, so he doesn't get looked into. And I did that very, very deliberately, because I didn't want him to... I mean, I always talk about him as being a combination of cause merchant and maverick. And so in a sense, he's not going to be looked at, because he's off the books. It's sort of like black operations every time he gets into onto a mission. So he has nobody checking him, basically.
And it wouldn't really apply to you, Adrian.
No, I started out very early reading Leslie Charteris' books, The Saint. Mm. And he was, to me, the ultimate buccaneer who could actually work outside the law. And never got looked at closely. I mean, Inspector Teal tried a few times and failed miserably. But I really wanted to write about characters who were the freebooters, who could do that kind of thing without being inspected. That's why I don't write police procedurals. There's also another reason, is I'm thoroughly lazy, and I didn't really want to have to account for all of the detail that people seem to want to find in books about police procedure and uniform and equipment and so on, because it all varies from county to county anyway, and is changing very, very quickly. So, no, I wanted mine to be outside that sort of, or I think out with, as they would say in Scotland, that kind of area of investigation. It kind of allowed them to do what they want within reason. It's up to me to actually, if I like, restrain them, so that where the morality comes to is they don't just go around slaughtering everybody, they just don't.
I think it's something, people are trying to bring more and more fact into fiction, and all the restrictions and the details and the little bits of procedure. Somebody said to me, one of the judges for the Daggers last year said to me, there's so much procedure creeping into police procedurals that people are forgetting to tell a good story at the same time. And you have to balance that, I think. So you do have to balance the regulations and the reality of what people are realistically allowed and not allowed to do. I mean, I was talking to Io last night, and she said she never reads any books with a courtroom scene in, because she's involved in the judiciary system. She said she knows instantly that it's all going to be full of mistakes, so she just can't look at them. So I think you try and you write round the regulations. But we were having a big discussion about, you know, all the introduction of new technology and mobile phones and instant communication and all that sort of thing, and how that has affected the crime novel, because now your hero is almost never out of constant touch with, you know, with somebody else. But as soon as you take any of that away, if it breaks down for any reason, people are more lost than they were before they came to rely on it. So it can, you know, you can get round it in interesting ways.
With
the investigation side, it's a big dilemma I have, because I was thinking, how can this chap keep, you know, going up against bad guys without there being any kind of recourse to be paid for it? The way I've got round of it is slightly outside of the law, acting as a cipher, for want of a better term, where he isn't responsible for the laws of his country, which again, why I set him in America. He's got, you know, he's travelled over to America, where he's got a little bit of anonymity at this moment in the story arc. But he also has roots to black operations, and that's where his strengths were when he was in the military. So he has that as a fallback plan. I don't want to give too much away of, you know, the story, but I've given him a little bit of a backdrop where he's still occasionally, unofficially on the books, if that makes sense. So he... And again, it's a little bit suspension of belief again involved here. But I didn't want want procedure or technology and not getting in the way too much, which is why I retired him. Didn't want to keep up to the minute with the latest James Bond gadgetry. You know, it's something that I think for me personally slows down books an awful lot. So his probably the technology he uses is a mobile phone. That's about it.
Yes, Jill.
I don't want to be rude, but I never like your sort of books. And I'm only here in the interest of trying to be open-minded. You've explained why you write these kind of books, and I found very interesting. Why do people read them?
I write the books I enjoy reading.
Oh, so you do.
Yeah, sorry, yes. I think we all do. You have to write the books you enjoy reading, and everybody has their own comfort levels when it comes to levels of violence and, you know, the graphic nature of it and whatever else. But you have to enjoy the sort of tales that suck you in and keep you turning the pages. So, and if you can try and get across something of a theme in with the entertainment and something of, you know, we've talked about morality tales, something of that nature in with it, then that's great. But basically we write escapist entertainment.
But still, why do other people like to read about torture?
It's safe. It's reading about it is safe. You know, it's like going on a roller coaster ride. You're frightened to death, but you know you're not. Nothing is going to happen to you, and you can get off at the end. And a book is safe. It's not like watching a scary film, where you know you have to plug your ears and hide behind the sofa when the nasty bits come on. If you don't like the book, you just shut it and put it down, and it's gone. You know, so it's a safety net. You people like these vicarious thrills, I think, and it's a little
it's
bit
the
rude.
Same with people who watch EastEnders. They just like to think, thank Christ, my family's not like that. It's distant, as Zoe said.
Yes,
you know,
you're
anyway. Well, you're not. No. It is at a distance, so it is a vicarious thrill in the same way hospital dramas and hospital books. My mother loved reading the Mills and Boone hospital stories. And I think she liked it because it was something she knew nothing about whatsoever. And I think most of us like to read something that's, use the word exotic is probably the wrong word, but it's at a distance. It's precarious, it's a thrill, it's dangerous, and so on.
But you've focused on torture. We've talked about lots of things, but it's the torture that really does it for you. But, I mean, the torture is, for me, is in one book, and it's a chapter. And there's lots of chapters, so it's only a tiny, tiny bit. So that, would that turn you off completely?
I'm very squeamish, I have to admit.
Yeah.
I don't like reading about torture or, you know,
fine.
Violent.
Each to their own. Each to their own.
I'm just trying to ask you why do people, really people do like to read about it.
But let's ask some readers. Let's ask some readers. Who likes reading about horrid things?
Gosh, Caro Ramsey's hand went up very quickly then.
I was actually in a bookshop.
We don't all read the same things. I read crime fiction, but a lot of my authors, they all write entirely different. Surely it's about variety, giving the reader the chance to take part in your type, another type,
I'm just trying to explain why people want to read about really nasty things.
Have you ever thought that you might affect the crime that's going on in the world with your different ideas?
We can't invent anything that hasn't already happened.
No, exactly. Yeah. Absolutely.
I just don't think that's possible. I mean, to give an illustration of whether people like this kind of thing is, I was in a bookshop a couple of years ago, and where I was doing my bit on a Saturday morning, the true crime section was just at the end of the bookshelves. And there was a little old lady in a flower pot hat who'd been leafing through these books about Charles Bronson and the Wells and all of this really gruesome stuff, which I cannot
I think you mean Charles Manson, don't you?
No, Charles Bronson, the lifer.
Oh, right, sorry.
Yeah. And it's really gruesome stuff, and she was leafing through it with great relish. And I thought, come this way and buy a book. You know, that's all I wanted to do. And she was reading through these books, and she was there for about an hour looking through all these books. And finally she turned away, and I thought, well, she's in here, she must need a read. She wasn't going to buy a true crime book. And as she went past, I said, oh, do you read crime fiction? She said, oh, she's only if it's not got any bad language in it. And I thought, well, there's the distinction, you know, that is, we can't cater for that. People do not like bad language, but they'll read about all sorts of gruesome stuff which we can't even put in print.
I just wonder why today crime is so important to all the films of crime that are popular, books, television, it's all dealing with crime.
Mm.
And what is it? Is it the forbidden things attract, or
the dark side, I think.
It's closure as well. Like I say, a lot of true crime or real life crime, you never find out what happened.
Yeah.
You never find out whether they caught anybody. You never find out whether justice was done. And if you read a crime novel, you will have closure by the end of the book of one form or another. It will have some kind of satisfaction that will get you to the end of the book.
Yes.
It has to shape and inform the character, and how people behave in extraordinary situations defines them, basically. And some of that is training and some of that is instinct, but how they behave. My character, she's come out of the military. She was a very good shot in the military. I used to be a competition shooter, so I've got that kind of background. And she then went into teaching self-defence. So that's not martial arts. Self-defence is a completely different aspect. And I went and learned a lot of self-defence, and I now do kind of little self-defence demos as well. But it does inform the way the character behaves, I think, a lot.
Adrian?
Yeah, I think you either start out with a menu of things you want your characters to possess by way of skills and training and, you know, insights, if you like, or you add them on afterwards. And I think I've read books where I got the impression of both kinds, where somebody finds themselves in extraordinary circumstances, the writer goes either one way of saying, well, then they call back to, as Matt was saying, somebody who's got a training, may not have used for many years in special forces, for example, or somebody who actually pretty quickly develops skills to actually cope with the situation. And the skills might just be purely mental. They might not be physical in the sort of pull out a gun and shoot, because most people in this room probably wouldn't know how to use a gun. At least I would hope not. But, you know, the way the world is changing. So you can sometimes assign skills to people that they really have to stop and think, well, which is the trigger? Where's the safety, if there is one? And, you know, and
how do you put the magazines?
That's right. How do I put the guns and the bullets in? You know, that sort of thing. So I think you either add them on or you start out with the menu.
There was a lovely thing. I mean, I loved reading the Clive Cussler, Dirk Pitt books, which is pure escapist fantasy. And there was one book I read where I picked it up and started reading it, and suddenly he was admiring his fencing trophies. And I thought, I don't remember that from any of the previous books. Sure enough, at the end, huge sword fight, never mentioned again.
Well, actually, I suppose I had a bit of a tick box, having been to this particular headquarters where they train firearms officers, and having been handed a Glock 17, which is linked to a computer, and then being told to go into a situation and you've got to look for a guy who's balding, who's carrying a weapon in a shopping centre, and you have to apprehend him. And so you have this sort of full film footage around you, and it's as though you're in a shopping centre, and you have people walking across you, and suddenly there's this bloke in front of you who kind of vaguely resembles the person you're supposed to be apprehending, and he gets up and he raises his weapon, drags a child over, and then I shoot, because that's what I'm supposed to do, and then there are two shots afterwards. And the whole thing took 20 seconds. And it was all replayed back to me, and I had to do a debrief. And I suddenly realised what a firearms officer actually has to do. And I thought, my God, what am I supposed to say? I don't remember what happened when I walked into this shopping centre, and I don't know what colour clothes this woman was wearing as she walked across me, and I don't know whether he had a cup of coffee in his hand or anything. And you have to do all of that stuff. And as a firearms officer, you are just trained to focus, to narrow it down, to be very detached, to be terribly objective, to know exactly where the exits are, to know exactly what's going on around you. And that type of thinking informed really how he operates throughout the whole of the novel. So he's looking at it through those eyes rather than me trying to do it and not doing it very well. And in fact, what happened was my reflexes were superb. I actually shot at the same time as the armed robber, or the armed gunman, I should say. And except I killed a passerby.
Killed what?
I killed a passerby. So I'd have been up before the court. So
that's just friendly fire.
Collateral damage.
Yeah, going back, I think with my character, it's a bit like having, if I took his unarmed combat skills and his shooting skills away, it'd be a bit like Robin Hood without a bow and arrow. You know, that's kind of where I'm coming from. So he's got these specific skills because of the specific job that he did, and you know, I'd feel like he was empty if he didn't have those skills, to be honest. And it's a little bit stylized, the combat in the books, obviously, because a real fight generally takes place over about 3 seconds, a lot of grunting and groaning and rolling about on the floor, you know. So because of the reality or the fictional aspects, it's, you know, it's a little bit more cinematic, and you know, the action isn't as gruesome as it's maybe coming across in the telling again, but it's more about the reality of combat, and that's what I've tried to get across.
I think we can fit in two questions. You first, because you were ahead of Toby.
There was a panel at Harrogate last year, which some people may remember. I think of it as the torture porn panel. I can't remember what they were supposed to talk about, but they were talking about horrible torture that they'd write in their books. Chelsea Kane was on the panel. And I really, in a way, it's not a question. I want to defend you people, because I don't think you are using torture in an unacceptable way, if I can put it that way, and I'm squeamish. Because those books seem to me to be huge amounts of torture. Slice and dice is a good thing. And not, well, maybe there was a point, because I couldn't bring myself to read the book to find out. And I think you are all writing books where torture is there for a point. And, you know, I'm the reader. I can slide my eye down quickly, which is what I normally do. You know, I can tell it's coming, and I think, you know, right, and then I'm fine. And I know the baddies were bad, and they tortured people, and then the story can carry on.
It's back to graphic and gratuitous again, isn't it? Yeah. It's that line.
We don't all write all about torture, though. I mean,
no, it's one scene in one book.
Only one of my 5 books contains any torture, so it's
you
kind of
potential. That's all.
There's potential. It's potential.
What are you
all?
Yeah.
Yes. None of you have touched on espionage novels, inspirations outside the usual police or legal system, like. I don't know if you've ever read Anthony Price or Le Carré, obviously. And were these kinds of inspirations to any of you?
I read John Le Carré, I read Alistair MacLean, and in some ways that did inspire me, because I have to say the female characters were a little bit kind of had to be rescued and fell over and twisted their ankles a lot. And if anybody was going to let the team down in an Alistair MacLean, it was almost undoubtedly going to be the woman. And I wanted to have a strong female character who wasn't kind of just a guy in nylons, as one American reader put it to me. So.
Anyone else?
I read plenty of spy thrillers and still do, and really enjoy them. In a way, I look on my two characters as being very similar to those in spy thrillers.
That's why they ask
they're operating outside the normal boundaries, as Eve said, you know, off the book, in a sense. So they're actually not that much different to my way of thinking.
Mm. Gerald Seymour, no relation. I think he writes fantastically about the intelligence services.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like the spy novels of David Morrell, who's famous for introducing First Blood, Rambo character, but he had a series, the Brotherhood of the Rose series, and also ones about a bodyguard and, you know, Fifth Profession and things. It's more those books that I attach to. I'm not a, you know, I'm not a big espionage reader. I have to, you know, tell the truth there. Although my character's an ex-spy, I retired him, so he wasn't a spy, if that makes sense. Yeah, but David Morrell had an impact on me. Yeah.
Right, now I'm just asking management to know, time is up. I was going to ask management if we could squeeze in one question from that gentleman, but sadly not. There will be book signings in the signing room. Thank you very much. We could have gone on. Very enjoyable. Thank you all.
Can I just make one last plea? The Criminal Tendencies anthology launch party is tonight in the club room at 5:30. Please come. It's for the breast cancer charities. It's apart from one entry, which is my own, it's an excellent anthology, and I can heartily recommend it.